is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150 plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Linsing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are jumping on to recap the 2020 NBA All-Star Weekend. Talk a little bit about the storylines heading into the last third of the season, and just look ahead to what may potentially happen down the road when we get to the NBA playoffs. Jay, let's start with the Rising Stars game. I know you said you watched most of that.
No, well, I watched. I want to be clear here. I didn't watch any of the game when it actually happened, but then I heard about the dunk contest thing, and I watched whatever someone had uploaded to YouTube, like the 3.5 minutes or something of the dunk contest. So that's what I watched. Them doing different dunks and fancy things, and that's basically was the gist of the rookie game that I watched. I opted to watch some other television shows / do some other things instead, because quite frankly I really wasn't interested. I knew Zion wasn't going to play a whole lot of minutes, and quite frankly I it just really didn't grab my, like, I wasn't excited. I was excited for everything else that last weekend, but that was just not the thing I was excited about.
Yeah, I would say that's my least, I have the least amount of interest in the Rising Stars game out of anything. Maybe the celebrity game. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, actually, Mike, this is embarrassing.
You watched the celebrity game?
I watched more of the celebrity game than I did the Rising Stars game, Mike.
That is, I don't know. I don't even know what to say to that one.
Yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to kind of see what these celebrities look like. And I'll be honest with you, they were really dragging in, like, the D-list celebrities this year. I mean, I think I recognized three of the people. That was it. Normally they get like Kevin Hart and other people, but I just didn't really latch on to anyone interesting.
Okay, can I just tell you this?
Yeah.
That's your first sign you're slipping into middle age, that you don't know any of the celebrities in the celebrity game.
Oh, well, yeah, that's true.
I got there a long time ago where I'm like, who are these people? I have no idea.
Well, yeah.
I got two questions from the Rising Stars game.
Okay.
Okay, first question. Should guys who are playing in the real All-Star game have to play in the Rising Stars game?
Well, see, and that's I don't think so. I think that's bizarre. Like, Luka's literally a starter in the All-Star game. Why is he
playing? And Trae Young.
Why are they playing in the Rising Star game? You could have filled a – they're already a star. They're starters. What the heck do you want from them? And the fact that they did all these things, and you go back, I don't know if you saw the article about why Trae Young and Luka Doncic played less minutes, and you'd have to imagine it, and I didn't read all the way through the article, but that would be exhausting, especially, I mean, Trae Young did something every single night, and having to play in that Rising Star Challenge, it's just bizarre. It's bizarre to me. I think it's kind of like, that would be like an MLB player playing in the Futures game and then also playing in the All-Star game, or and I guess there's no equivalent to the NFL because there's no, like, second league Oh, well, there's the XFL, but that's although I have to say, Mike,
Is that the joke you were saving for me?
No, that's not the joke I was saving for you. However, okay. I want to say something really quickly about the XFL. It's actually somewhat enjoyable to watch that, the XFL, and I'm assuming you haven't watched any of it, but
I did actually watch some because I was at my relative's house,
and it was on the TV.
And it was on. So I watched that before the Duke Carolina game came on. So
XFL. Cardale Jones looks really good, and I'm like, well, he's playing against a bunch of bums, but at the same time, it's intriguing. I think that they have a chance to survive. But that's all we'll say. We'll save that for our XFL podcast if we branch off into the future.
That's right. That's right. Once we get the podcast network going, XFL hosts, we're looking for you out there.
Yeah, reach out. hoopheadspod@gmail.com. Anyways, so that was the Friday night stuff. I don't know.
I got to ask my second. I got to ask my second question. So first of all, I agree with you. I don't think there's no way those guys should be playing in the Rising Stars game when they're All Star starters. Even if they're on the All Star team, I think that excludes you from having to play. Although I guess maybe you give them a choice if they wanted to play. I have no idea. Did they want to play? Would they not have played if they have had a choice? I have no idea what their personal feelings would have been about it, but I don't think that it should be compulsory that if you're starting in the All-Star game or you're on one of the real All-Star teams, you should not have to play if you don't want to in the Rising Stars game. So that's my answer to that question. And then the second question I had about the Rising Stars game, clearly there are four guys who I think have probably established themselves that we feel like they're going to end up having tremendous NBA career. So you have Zion, you have Ja Morant, you have Trae Young, and you have Luka Doncic, all who are clearly two of them already are all stars. I think it's only a matter of time before Ja and Zion join Trae.
Let's be honest, if Zion was healthy, he's an all star this year, probably.
Yeah, I'd say there's a pretty good chance. It certainly seems like, based on what his production's been to this point, that he would have had a great chance to be on the all star team. So if you eliminate those four guys, and you had to pick one or maybe two guys to have the best career out of anybody, who would you take? Now, I can read you the roster. I don't know if you have the rosters in front of you.
I don't have the rosters in front of me. I mean, I have an answer.
What's your answer?
And we kind of talked a little bit before the podcast, but I would definitely think that SGA. I'm not going to attempt to say his name. I would say he's shown flashes of brilliance this year, and even last year he showed it. And I think I really think that, you know what, I'm going out on a limb here, Mike. I think by the time his career is over, we're going to say that he's a better player than Trae Young. I'm saying that right now. I think he will be a better player than Trae Young by the end of his career. Will he start in an All-Star game? I don't know if we can go that far, but I think that he's going to be a better player long-term than Trae Young. I'm saying
the question with Trae Young becomes, can he be the best player on a championship team?
The answer is no.
When you don't defend and when you're that size, I think it's just really, really difficult. He's going to have the perfect team built around him.
Mike, I'm telling you, the answer is no.
Okay, so then we're basing, I think, Trae Young's statistics. His statistical case is probably going to be stronger at the end of their careers than SGA's, but I think as far as being a winning player who impacts both ends of the floor, I don't think you're wrong. I could see that end up playing out where Trae Young has the statistics, but SGA has the wins. And I don't know that he's ever going to be the best player on a championship team either, but I think his ceiling is probably a solid number two and maybe even a number three, depending upon where the league goes. But he's very, very good. I don't know that Trae Young ever gets to the best player on a championship team. Second best player, maybe.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, let's move on. Enough Rising Stars.
Okay, so we're moving to Saturday night. So we'll start with the skills challenge and the big guys. I didn't realize that they had won so many times in the last few years. As I was watching, they were saying, I think, four of the last 6 years or three of the last 4 years had been big guys. And then every single contest throughout the whole thing, the tallest person won, Mike. Every single, yep. I don't think is Bam taller than Sabonis? I didn't I think that might have been the only outlier.
I think they might be the same. They might be the same. Maybe Sabonis is a little taller, but yeah, clearly two, but two big guys.
I think my favorite part of the whole thing was Dwayne Wade completely saying Bam can't shoot, and then Bam won the whole thing. Like right out the gate, he said, "Oh, Bam can't shoot. If he misses it, he's done." And then he ended up winning. So it was pretty quality there.
I think what it points out to me is just the fact that everybody in today's game can shoot. And if you can't shoot, it becomes very, very difficult for anyone to find a place for you to play. You just become such a liability on the offensive end of the floor the way the game is played. So everybody in that contest, big, small, everybody could shoot to some varying degree. Whereas if you go back,
except for Chris Middleton.
If you go back to sorry,
he almost airballed that shot.
I know. It was bad. I thought he was looking good there for a second, but it just didn't work out for him. But you go back 25 or 30 years, and there's no way that players of that size are shooting the ball that well from the perimeter to the point where they can beat the guards. And as people are going through the fake defenders and weaving around through the cones and then throwing the pass, obviously that's a skill that doesn't really
I think they need to change it though, Mike, and here's why I'm going to say they need to change it. The guys didn't even look like they were going full tilt bogey on that. They looked like they were going so casual like throughout the whole thing.
I agree, and it almost feels like it needs to be longer. Like that thing is over so fast. It just is. Okay, they weave through, they throw the pass, they take the layup, then they go down the other end and take a shot. The whole thing takes like 15 seconds, and it almost seems anticlimactic. I'd like to see them do something.
Maybe they should pull out some of those trainer videos and use those to come up with a better obstacle course, the ones that are impossible.
I think they should do as part of it is I think they should play some buzzer beater.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good game, Mike.
It'd be fun, right?
I brought from Camp Worcester, Camp Fighting Scott. And we use it at our summer skills challenge. That's a really good idea, Mike.
I like it. So they could have to weave through the defenders, then they first have 5 seconds, and then you have 4 seconds, then you have 3 seconds, then you have two, then you have one, and the last guy remaining who makes that buzzer beater is the winner. I think that could be fun. Now, I'm not sure there's a ton of skill necessarily, although I have heard that NBA players do enjoy practicing their half-court shots and their crazy.
Really? No way.
I have heard that. So it could be something that would be fun.
By the way, going back to the Rising Stars Challenge, half-quarter that Luka Doncic hit was pretty nice.
That was nice. That was a good half-court shot. Yeah. I liked it.
So Adam Silver, if you like, we take a very low consultation fee on fixing the skills challenge. You could reach us once again. Man, I'm really plugging our email. Hoopheadspod@gmail.com. Anytime you are interested, reach out.
Buzzer beater. Let's make it happen. Make it happen, NBA.
Yeah. All right. So now we're going to move to the three-point contest. And I want to see. I was totally prepared, Mike, going into the final round. Totally prepared to take the victory since I picked Dame Lillard to win the three-point contest and he got injured. And if Devin Booker would have won, I would have claimed it as a victory because.
Well, I had Bertans.
He essentially replaced Dame Lillard. So I was going to say like Dame like embodied him to go shoot, although Dame couldn't have because he was preparing to perform as Dame Dollar, which we definitely have to discuss after we discuss this. But the three-point contest, I have to say, I like the addition of the Mountain Dew thing because it definitely threw people into like a – they weren't as comfortable. I feel like they were – but at the same time, I think they didn't think they needed to add 10 seconds because it looked like they were just kind of – they weren't – once again, like compared to the skills, they didn't seem like they were moving at full speed. And there were – I don't think there was a single person that didn't finish. Was there anyone that didn't finish the whole
round? There were a couple guys that came close. I didn't mind the extra time because I feel like I'd rather watch the guy shoot the regular motion than chuck the ball up just to get it up there. So I was okay with that. The one thing that stood out for me, and I liked the addition of the long shot because clearly, just like we talked about with the skills challenge and big guys shooting threes, the trend now obviously is everybody shooting 25, 28, 30-footers. And so adding two of those shots into the contest seems like it's going along with the natural progression of the game. What I was struck with was pretty much every guy, there was no one who altered their shooting motion in order to get the ball to the basket from that distance. Every guy looked exactly the same. Their shooting stroke looked identical on the racks that were right up at the three-point line versus the Mountain Dew ball. So I was struck by that. I was also struck as I'm watching and just observing how these guys shoot the basketball. And clearly there's some minor differences in the way they release the ball and how they get the ball up into the shooting pocket. But ultimately, every one of those guys has what you would call, if you just looked at it in a vacuum, pretty much perfect form. Their guide hand is completely flat on the side of the ball. They're taking it off. Their guide hand's not involved in the shot. Everything's just being shot with their dominant shooting hand. And I'm sure if you go back and you watch guys shoot in 1985, you would come nowhere near seeing that same identical form. I think it speaks to some of the things that we've talked about here on the podcast, just the amount of training and shooting practice and expertise that there is out there helping guys understand how they have to shoot the ball and just how if you have perfect mechanics, it's so much easier to be a great shooter than if your mechanics are all screwed up. You can still be a good shooter.
So now you tell me that.
I'm sorry, but you can still be a good shooter with screwed up mechanics, but it just takes a lot more reps in order to make that happen.
Well, that's something I didn't do, sadly, when I was a kid because I didn't have the heart for it, and I really wish I would, Mike. You know, I wish I would have. But anyway, sorry, that's going on my own diatribe here. But I definitely agree. I think that, I have to say, I don't know what it was about the three-point contest this year, but it wasn't as exciting as it had been. Now, I know that I added the Mountain Dew thing, and I thought that was a cool wrinkle, and I just didn't feel as excited about it as I did last year.
Maybe
it's because Steph didn't compete. Maybe it's because Clay didn't compete. Maybe it's because I didn't have a, so to speak, dog in the fight, although I was pulling for Joe Harris to repeat because then, it would just been cool to have him repeat. But I really felt like I didn't have a dog in the fight. And then maybe it's because Dame didn't compete, and that's who I picked, and I was really just not as interested as that I thought I was going to be. I don't know.
Well, here's what I would do, and I think they used to do it this way, and I'm not sure when it went away, but I still think, and I understand why they did it.
Are you saying having two people go at once?
Yeah, I would have them go head-to-head, and here's why. I think the head-to-head, what makes it more exciting is if I'm shooting at one end and I'm on a streak where I'm missing and still the crowd is cheering and going crazy, I know the guy at the other end is banging him home. Well, and that puts just a little bit more pressure on me, makes it a little bit more game-like, and I just think there's a little bit more gamesmanship involved. So I know why they did it. I know why they did away with that, because you could have one guy that makes 27 and another guy that scores 26, and the guy with 26 gets eliminated. Meanwhile, there's a rock fight in the other pairing where guy makes 12 and the other guy makes 10.
Here's how you fix that, Mike. You ready?
Okay. Yeah, I'm ready.
You have 10 people, okay? Or I don't know how many you start with. You have 12 people, and you go from 12, you go head-to-head, and you get 6, and then the top two scorers that did not win move on to the second round. And then you're down to 8, and you go, you got the 4. Then at that point, then you go straight head-to-head. Because that means at least one round of, oh, crap, I got matched up against a guy who scored, 25 or 24. And, yes, I know that would take longer. It would take, someone would have to shoot 4 times to win it or whatever. But at the same time, I think that would make it more exciting and to have them go against each other. And I think, actually, it probably would take exact same amount of time as it does because they only do one at a time now. And I think they had 10 guys in this one this year, right? Was it 8 or 10?
I think they started with 9, I think, before 9. Lillard dropped out. So I think they ended up with 8.
Well, no, Booker replaced him.
Oh, yeah, so 9. So I think they had 9. I think 9. So,
but I think there's a way that you could work around this and make it, Yeah. I think the head-to-head thing would make it way more interesting. I agree.
Yeah, I just think, again, it makes it more exciting when there's something going on at the other end. It's possible for you to get distracted and look out of the corner of your eye at what the other guy's scoring.
Even if it wasn't head-to-head and they just had two guys going at once, I think that would make – I would be okay with that, We start with 9 and we narrow it down to 4 and we still have two guys going at once. And I still think that would be interesting. It doesn't necessarily have to be head-to-head, I don't know. But
yeah, I'm not sure what the reasoning was why they took the head-to-head away. I mean, like I said, I think it's probably because of what I said about the scores, but your solution seems to make sense. So far,
Adam Silver.
So far we've fixed the skills challenge. Let's add buzzer beater, and we want head-to-head in the three-point contest.
Oh, God. Okay, Mike, are we ready to fix the slam dunk contest? Because I'm ready to fix the slam dunk contest. All right,
I'm ready to fix it.
So, listen, we talked during the whole thing, throughout the whole thing we were texting. The fact that the white man can't dunk didn't get him into the finals, that was the first atrocity. Well, I guess the first atrocity was having Dwight Howard in the slam dunk contest, Mike. I mean, that was an atrocity because he didn't do anything exciting. Nah. He did nothing.
Dwight had, I mean, you knew he wasn't going to do anything. He had no business being in there. I think what it speaks to is something that I'll talk about in a minute about just the general problems with the slam dunk. But I'm curious to hear where you're going with your
take here. The first thing is Dwight being an atrocity. Second thing, Pat Connaughton literally jumps over Giannis. A, dunks the ball beautifully. B, he could have seriously injured Giannis Antetokounmpo, who is the best player in the National Basketball Association. We don't take that into consideration. That was the first issue. So then we get into this dunk off nonsense. Which,
all right, wait. Let me address the Connaughton thing.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
All right. So the Connaughton dunk over Giannis off the backboard and then dunking the ball.
That is original.
Original. Extremely, extremely difficult. I've tried to do that on an 8-foot basket.
Oh, I was gonna say, Mike, you can't even jump to your 10-foot.
When I was 17, I'm sure I tried to do that on an 8-foot basket. It's pretty hard. But the thing is that if you look at what Connaughton lacked, the reason why that dunk didn't sell is because he barely had some fingers on the rim after he dunked it, and he just didn't have a finishing.
The showmanship.
Right. He didn't have the finishing flair. Like, he had a little bit at the end after he landed, and he was kind of trying to explain what he did, and, you know, beforehand, and obviously the white men can't jump thing was cool. But his finish, the flourish with how Derrick Jones Jr. and Aaron Gordon and slam dunk champions of the past, the way they finish dunks, the way you land, the way you hang on the rim, all that stuff matters, and Connaughton didn't bring that. So I would have liked to see him make it because I would have been curious to see what else he had up his sleeve because the two things that he did were phenomenal. But I don't think he should have advanced compared to the other two guys off of that contest because, again, he just didn't have the same amount of flair to his finish that Gordon and Derrick Jones Jr. did. Now let's go on to that.
Okay, so now we go to Derrick Jones Jr., Aaron. What a joke. I mean, so this thing just goes back and forth. And I'm of the mindset that they can't end in a tie. I'm completely of the mindset. Why they went instead of doing vote, I don't understand the tiebreak procedure. Why they kept just going 50-50. After that last round, they literally should have said, okay, you five judges, you have to pick the person that you think had the best dunks all night. That's what they need to do.
Or what you could have done. Here's another solution. Yeah, you could have said, okay, give us your overall vote on who was the best dunker. You could have done that when it ended tied. That would have been a possibility. Yeah. The other possibility that they could have done there is said, okay, you each have one more dunk. Right? Each have one more dunk. Let's watch both dunks. And then just pick which one you like better.
Yep.
And you have to pick one or the other. And so that eliminates the everybody looking up and down judges row. All right, who's going to give him the 9? Who's going to give him the 10?
It was obvious. That's Wade completely did that intentionally at the end. Did you watch the WOB investigations? I think I sent that to you.
Yeah, that was good. I enjoyed that.
Like, it was clear that Wade was the one that screwed it up. And why wouldn't he? He played with the guy last season. He's best buds with that guy. That's exactly. There's no reason that Wade should have been involved in being a judge. He literally played with one of these guys as a teammate. Like, there's not that you can't say that he wasn't going to have some kind of bias. None of the other judges had played with any of those guys. Obviously, none of them were NBA players in the last, I don't know, you know, bunch of years. But I just don't think – I think that was another crime. They had Wade on there because he obviously threw it to the Miami guy. I mean, he just said, okay, I'm just going to give him a nine and start walking, taking the earpiece off and walking away. So I think, you know, if I'm Aaron Gordon, I'd be pretty pissed off right now, and I would definitely not do the slam dunk contest. Now, that being said, he said afterwards that he wasn't going to probably do it again. Does that mean in 3 years he's not going to come back? Maybe he will in 3 years. Maybe, you know. I just think they need to change something. They need to make an adjustment. They need to have – I think the way to go about fixing it is having only all-time greats or having, like, women players or things like that, not having any people that currently or recently retired. I think they need to go back to using the older school guys to do the judging because I think that would go better. And – you know, I don't know if there's a way to introduce a different aspect to it to get the voting better. But, you know, I think I heard Simmons talking about making it a 20-point scale and things like that. But I don't necessarily know that's going to fix anything, you know, because then we're just going to be in the same situation where we're giving 20s. But I do agree that maybe a fix would be if they miss a dunk, they can't get a 10. Like, you can't give them a 10 if they miss a dunk. I would be okay with that because, theoretically, if we're doing this dunk contest, it should be you're going to do it and you're going to make it on the first try, right? Right. That would be the goal. So if they miss it, okay, you automatically lost a point. Every time you miss a dunk, you lose a point. I think that could be, you know, a way to fix it.
I guess the argument against that would be that then you're stifling guys' creativity because – I know if I go for this dunk that is difficult or there's a toss off the backboard that has to be perfect or I got to grab the ball off some guy's head, that if it doesn't go well, I potentially am losing that score. It's kind of like the old, whatever, figure skating, gymnastics, where there's like a max score.
Get the Russian judge.
Well, no, it's more like there's a max score.
I know what you're saying.
Because of degree of difficulty. And so yeah. I might perform an easier dunk, but that dunk has a lower ceiling. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's just I think you get into
maybe you just if you miss the dunk you lose a point.
How about if we
you can't lose more than 1 point?
How about if we just judge it correctly?
What? Come on, man.
How about that? How about
have
we
you
just
seen
judge it correctly?
Have you seen the American public and who they're electing? You think we can judge anything correctly? I'm not going to get into politics, but come on now.
Okay. All right, well, I'm going to leave that one alone. But let's go ahead and. Before, let me preface my comments here by saying that Derek Jones Jr. is an incredible, incredible, unbelievable, incredible dunker. The dunks that he did were amazing. There's probably only 10 guys in the league who can even come close to attempting some of those things that he did. And yet, every dunk, with the exception of his dunk from the foul line or a foot inside the foul line, were a variation of him going between the legs. And that's not to say that there wasn't some variation to them, throwing them off the backboard, grabbing them off people's heads, spinning the opposite way on the 360. All great, all amazing, all fantastic, but all some version of I'm going between my legs and I'm dunking it.
You know what's funny is that's how I do all my dunks, Mike.
I understand. Between the legs. It's become pretty standard fare, so I know you're throwing those down all the time.
Yep.
I do that on my Nerf hoop here at home a lot. I would like to work on those, try to reenact the dunk contest. But I think what it comes down to for me there is that Aaron Gordon had the dunk that Markel Fultz threw off the backboard to him, where he caught it and windmilled it with one hand, 360, and dunked it. That was clearly, at least in my mind, the best dunk of the night. And quite frankly, it wasn't even close, as impressive as everything else that went on.
Yeah.
And if you're Aaron Gordon and you've done five dunks and they've all been 50s, and I've said it to some people that I've been talking to about the dunk contest at various places since it happened on Saturday night, that the Taco Fall dunk was the least impressive of his dunks. I mean, if I was going to rate one not a 50, that would probably be the one I would rate not a 50, simply because he just jumped over him and dunked it and didn't do anything else around that. Now, that's keeping in mind that he's 7 foot six. Jumping over a 7 foot six human being is pretty impressive in its own right. But I just think that what Gordon brought to the table in terms of ingenuity, in terms of each of his dunks being different compared to Derrick Jones Jr., who had some variation of the between the legs dunk on everything that he did. I just think that Gordon had to be the winner. And the fact that it came down to whatever, whether it was D-Wade or whoever it was that broke the pact that they were going to continue to remain tied, it just seems like the wrong guy won. And that's a shame. And I'm not sure the wrong guy won back when Zach LaVine won it, but you could certainly make the case that Aaron Gordon could have won that one as well. And now you've got two controversial losses. As you said in his interview afterwards, he said, I'm not coming back to the dunk contest, which totally understandable. And yet at the same time, you could see where, oh, I've lost two. I want to come back and I want to get one. But he can't have much faith in the process, which goes to, I think, what the big fix is. And this isn't necessarily a fix for the judging, but I think what makes the dunk contest even better is stars. And the fact that, you know, you look back at the historic 1988 dunk contest when you had Dominique going against Jordan, you're talking about two all-time top, I don't know, depending on where you want to rank Neek, two top 20, top 30 players in the history of the NBA going at it. And then I'm sure we could look at the rest of the field filled with marketable stars. And here you're looking at Dwight past his prime, Aaron Gordon, I think most people would say he's probably had an underachieving career to this point. Derrick Jones Jr. rarely, if ever, plays. Connaughton's like the eighth man on the Bucks. There just isn't the star power that makes it interesting. And so we obviously have two guys sitting there at All-Star Weekend who everybody would have wanted to see, young guys and Zion and Ja Morant. Let's hope at some point that we get to see the two of them. I still think it's criminal that we never saw LeBron once in a dunk contest. To me, that's a travesty for the league that they were never able to convince him one time to get in there and dunk. And I'm not sure what the league can do to make it happen to get stars. I know that it's kind of out of their control whether guys want to do it or don't want to do it. But, man, how much more exciting would that contest have been if you could have had LeBron, Ja,
I think that Zion. That drum has been beaten too many times. That's not happening, Mike. LeBron.
No, I know LeBron's past his prime. He probably couldn't win it against these guys anyway. But in terms of guys you'd want to see in there, wouldn't the dunk contest be so much better if you had the best players in the game in the dunk contest? It's just more exciting. Again, there's a reason why they're the best players. They're the most exciting, the guys that are most popular. They have that flair that I was talking about, the flourish on their finishes, the things that make what they do stand out to people. And so I just think that you're missing out by not having those stars. Like I said, I don't know what the league can do to fix that, but it'd be great to see. Again, I just hope that at some point in the future we get to see Zion and Ja in a dunk contest at least once, because I think what they'd come up with would be phenomenal.
Yep, I agree. All right. Man, we've talked a lot about this All-Star. We haven't even gotten to the game yet. You know, you'd almost think that Chaka Khan was still performing the national anthem, Mike. There you go. That was it for you. That was there for there. I can't
I'll
believe.
Tell you,
we're,
I'll tell
listen,
you.
She was on The Masked Singer. I don't know if you know this. Probably not. But she was the last Masked Singer. And I was like, man, didn't even know Chaka Khan was still able to sing, let alone do that. So they had her on The Masked Singer, and then, like, literally a few days they revealed her, and then a few days later she's performing at the All-Star Game, and I'm like, why did they pick Chaka Khan? I know, is she from, I'm assuming she's got to be from Chicago, right?
From Chicago, yes.
Come on, there has to be someone that from Chicago that could have performed a better, and what's the even better is, someone had to listen to that during, like, warm-ups or like pregame, and they still allowed her to do that. My gosh, was that horrendous? That has to be there, right with the Carl Lewis national anthem.
Well, and the Fergie one.
Oh, listen, Fergie's excited because that was worse than her. Sorry, That was 100% worse than hers.
They were both pretty bad. I just when they rolled out Chaka Khan, I can still remember being on my driveway when I was like 12, listening to the Chaka Khan. Like, and then they brought her out. I'm like, oh my god! Like, part of me was like, she's still alive. Like, seriously, I couldn't believe it. And yeah, that was not a good
answer. I will say one thing to the pregame. I don't want to belabor the point. I thought the pregame stuff for Kobe was really cool. But I have to say, I thought Common did a great job. And I'm not really into that kind of stuff. I thought he did a good job. And I really thought he did a great job. Probably the best job introducing the All-Stars that I've seen, at least. Like, just rhyming all their names. I thought that was really cool. And the fact that he came up with something to rhyme with Antetokounmpo was impressive. Impressive.
I'm going to refrain from comment on that. It was fine, but I didn't.
You weren't as enthralled with as it.
It didn't. I don't know. I can do without the 20-minute.
Yeah, but that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen.
I know. It was fine.
So I'm saying compared to other years when they were like rising out of the floor and fireworks are shooting out.
Yeah, I agree.
I thought it was better.
It was fine. I'm good. I'm good with it.
Okay. All right. So the All-Star game. So I will be completely transparent. I watched the first quarter. I didn't really watch much of the second quarter because my child wasn't cooperating.
That was the Giannis quarter.
I watched the last 4.5 minutes of the third quarter, and then I watched every single minute of the fourth quarter. And that fourth quarter, Mike, I couldn't have asked for a better fourth quarter in an All-Star game. You can correct me if I'm wrong. In my 33 years of existence, okay, it is definitely the best fourth quarter All-Star game I've ever watched. I can't think of another time that was any better. Now, to be fair, I know there was probably a good early 90s one, but I was only 4 or 5, so I don't really remember it. But I feel it's definitely in the last 20 years, which I can remember, the best fourth quarter in an All-Star game that I can think of.
In recent memory, it clearly is. And I think you and I were dubious of the format going into it. I just didn't see where it would motivate the players in any way. I didn't think the resetting the score after every quarter, the playing for charity, I didn't think that would have an impact. And to be honest, I didn't really think that the Elam ending and playing to a certain score was going to make a difference. But I think what got underestimated by me and maybe by a lot of other people is the fact that really what it came down to is that became
a pickup game.
It became a pickup game on the playground where you get down to game point and it gets tense because the game can end on every single
possession. Free throw.
Right. Well, we'll talk about that in a second. But at any given point, once a team gets to within 3, every single possession could end the game at that point. And that really created a lot of tension. It created a lot of effort. It created a situation where those guys competed. They competed offensively. They competed defensively. They did their usual complaining to the refs that you see in regular season or playoff games, which you almost never see in an All-Star game. And it was amazing to see.
We had challenges. We had challenges.
Yeah. It was just amazing to see the desire of guys actually wanting to win that game. And as you said,
you had Kemba Walker jacking up terrible shots.
Kemba was what, 0-for-6 in the fourth quarter?
Yeah,
I think.
He was terrible.
He was bad. So that we could talk lineups here in a second, but let's just finish out the stuff with the ending. And I just thought that it set up a really cool setup where, again, it's like a pickup game. There's game winners that are just waiting to be had, and it worked. Kudos to the NBA. It worked. It got guys to compete. It was by far the most competitive I've seen an All-Star game in the last, 20 years probably.
Since Bird and Jordan?
Maybe. I mean, it really was enjoyable to watch. You could tell that those guys wanted to win. You could tell that they cared about the outcome. And I don't think you can always say that in the last few years. I think there was definitely a huge drop off in the level of care that the players had in terms of the one loss record and who was going to win. And now, hopefully, this is back. And it'll be interesting to see. I think the league has to take some, something away from this and say, hey, this is something we got to look at if they end up going to a midseason tournament or you end up going to playoff play-in games or whatever it ends up being. I think they're going to look long and hard at this after what they saw in the All-Star game. In a game where there was no stakes at all, it still ratcheted up the intensity. So imagine if there's some type of game where there's some actual stakes involved that really means something that guys care about, how that would look. And I just think it would be a lot of fun. So good job by the NBA of coming up with this. Yep. Good job of coming and thinking out of the box, trying something new. It worked. It, without question, worked.
It's, you know what's really funny, Mike? I was just looking it up because I knew the Cavs, the Cleveland has it in 2 years, but I was trying to see where they have it next year. Man, they really like the Midwest over the next few years. Is it, they're in Indiana next year. They were in Chicago this year. They're in Cleveland the year after that. And then they're going out to, God, I can't even imagine the chaos that's going to happen when they play in Utah in 2023. Because, I mean, I don't know if there's a lot to do in Salt Lake City, Utah. But maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong, Mike. But I just know that they've talked about, I don't know, they talked about how the Chicago one, everything was so spread out. And they really, it was like an endeavor to get anywhere. I can't imagine, I don't know, Indiana's, is there a stadium in Indianapolis, Mike? Do you know?
Yes. Yes.
So that one's probably close, not quite Chicago, but probably close to Charlotte's kind of situation, right?
I mean, I would think,
and I know, I mean, heck, Cleveland's very much like Charlotte. I mean, it's going to be, everything's going to be in the same general area. There's not a lot going, so it's just interesting.
Utah will be the same.
Yeah, Utah will be the same. It's interesting that they're kind of going to all these like mid-market. I mean, I know Chicago's not a mid-market, but I would definitely say Indianapolis is a mid-market. I would say Cleveland's a mid-market. I would say that Salt Lake City's a mid-market, right? Would you agree with all that?
I mean, I would
agree. It's interesting that they're going to these places. But, yeah, I definitely thought the game was really good. I enjoyed the fourth quarter, and I definitely think that this is something they should consider for the in-season tournament if they end up going that route, which I think they're going to. I think they're trying to get out in front of making some changes that is going to benefit the game, and I think it's going to happen. So I think they'll look into it. I think it was just definitely interesting. And obviously, I've not watched much of the TBT. I don't know if you've watched much of the TBT.
No, I have not.
The summer stuff. I watched the championship game last year because the Ohio State crew was in it, and it was just interesting to watch them play, including Greg Oden. But it was just I didn't really realize the ending. I didn't remember how the ending occurred because that's how they end all the games in the TBT is with the Elam ending. I have not got a chance to listen to the Zach Lowe interview. He actually interviewed him today. Did you listen to that yet or no?
I did not.
Yeah, he released it this afternoon, so I'm going to definitely listen to it because I just want to hear like how he came up with it and what exactly, you know, caused him to come up with it. And it'd be intriguing to me, so I'm definitely interested to hear that. But we'll see what happens.
All right, last thing about that, and then let's talk about a little bit about the lineups and some of the things that we saw with individual players because I have some interesting thoughts on kind of what went on in the game. But the last thing about the ending is I think you have to figure out the free throw piece of it.
I think it's kind of like 33. He should have had to make both free throws. I think that's the way it would have solved that problem. Like, in order to get that point, get two free throws.
Yeah, even that, though, I'm not sure. I still don't want that game with as intense as it was with everything that was going on. I still don't want it ending on a free throw.
How about this? If every free throw he makes, the other team loses a point, and then you get the ball.
Yeah, but you still got to the point total with the free throw. That's
no. What I'm saying is, he was at 156. The other team was at 154. If he makes a free throw instead of gaining a point, the other team loses a point because he can't win. Or is that just too convoluted to do it that way? You see what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, I see what you're saying. That's not bad.
Adam Silver, call me up. I'm up for consultation on how to fix that free throw at the end of the All-Star game.
Yeah, I think you just take it out. And now, do you get to the point where teams are just hacking? I mean, you hope not, especially not in a meaningless All-Star game. Now, maybe if you try to do that in the NBA Finals, you'd probably have guys just hacking left and right anytime anyone got near the basket trying to take a shot. So I don't think it would work on that instance. But there has to be some way that, you know, taking points off the board, like you mentioned, is a possibility. I'm sure there's some other things out there that they could do. But it would have been great to see it end on a made field goal. And yet, especially after he missed the first free throw, that was a pretty pressure free throw. And
so do you hear they supposedly told him that he was going to miss the first one intentionally?
Who told him that? Who said that?
I heard that on something. It was either on a podcast or on ESPN. Someone said they were in an interview that Anthony Davis said he was going to miss the first one to mess with everyone and then make the second one. And I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I heard. I know I heard that's what I heard.
If he did that, that was a pretty convincing first miss, because it's hard to miss long the way he missed like that.
I know, I agree.
I kind of don't think that was true. All right, let's talk fourth quarter lineups and just some of the things that went on during the game that I found to be interesting. I think one thing that I found to be really interesting was how good Chris Paul looked in this game. The dunk on the off the alley-oop, which I was sitting here and I had a friend over and we were watching while our families were playing some board game. And that dunk happened, and he and I looked at each other. We're like, "Wait, was that Chris Paul?" I don't remember Chris Paul. I honestly can say I don't remember a Chris Paul dunk ever. Now that's not to say that I'm sure he's dunked, but I do not. I have no recollection of a Chris Paul dunk. So the fact that he dunked that was incredible. And then
he didn't hurt his hamstring.
Did not hurt his hamstring, but he looked really, really good. And
okay, Mike, here's my question on Chris Paul.
Okay.
How do you think Houston felt watching that game?
I don't know. I mean,
I know he's not tipping the scale, but of the three players, he was the best player, right?
Right. But I think here's what you have to think about. If you're Houston, one, obviously the relationship between Harden and Paul became untenable, and so you just had to get Chris Paul out. That's number one. Number two, we could say what we want about Russell Westbrook and all the faults he has, but the guy's averaging 26.5 points a game, whatever, 8 rebounds and 8 assists. So it's not like the guy that you brought in is unproductive and you got fleeced in the trade. I think the problem is that in order to make that all happen, the Rockets sent out multiple first-round picks to get off the Chris Paul contract, to bring in Westbrook, and then sent out another first-round pick to bring in Covington. And so that's, I think, where the problem lies with the Rockets. But Chris Paul looked good, I guess, bottom line. And then it ended up that at the end of the game, Chris Paul's in the game instead of the starter, Luka, who barely played at all and didn't play. I don't think he played at all in the fourth quarter. But just interesting that Chris Paul ends up suiting up and playing all those minutes in the fourth quarter for Team LeBron. And then on the other side with Team Giannis, like at a certain point, after Kemba Walker gets to about 0-for-3, and he's not a starter. Oh, I'm sorry, he is a starter. It's just I think I would have pulled Kemba out. And Lowry made some good defensive plays, but I'm not sure the Lowry Kemba Walker backcourt was a winning combination for Team Giannis.
How about the theory that Nick Nurse played Embiid a lot of more minutes than he averages in a game because he's trying to wear him down for the long run? I thought that was good.
I'm not sure I really buy into that.
But yeah, his lineups were just bizarre. And then you look at, I mean, once again, you just look at LeBron's team, and I just felt like his team was just way better. Like you had Luka, you had Jason Tatum, and you had someone is escaping me right now. Literally sitting on the bench, not playing in the fourth quarter.
Whereas Simmons was on LeBron's team. Right?
Oh yeah, Simmons didn't play at all in the fourth quarter. So, like those three guys, I think if Giannis has any of those three guys, they're definitely on the floor ahead of a few of the people that were on the floor at the end of the game, right? Or am I wrong in that statement?
No, I think you're right. But it's just I don't know. It was weird. The thing that stood out to me as the most surprising, or not even surprising, but just something that I think is worth keeping an eye on, is down the stretch, the ball never found its way to Giannis. And I don't know if that's because Giannis didn't want it. I don't know if that's because Giannis really doesn't necessarily have a go-to move against that kind of defensive pressure. If I was a Bucks fan, which I sort of am a Bucks fan, that made me a little nervous, because when those guys stepped up their intensity on defense, and there were a couple times early in the fourth, at least, where Giannis got the ball and he tried to drive in and he got walled off and he had to kick it out. But I just wonder, in those big moments, you think about what Kawhi did last year for the Raptors, where he gets the ball, he can't get all the way to the basket, but now he's got the one or two dribble pull up from 17 feet, or he's got the little post up or whatever. I'm not sure what Giannis's go-to move is in the half court. And watching that game, what stood out to me was Team Giannis didn't win because they didn't have a guy who could get them a bucket. They tried to go to Embiid a couple times, and that didn't really work. And I just kept waiting for Giannis to get the ball and go, all right, guys, I got this. And I never saw him do that. And that worries me if I'm a Bucks fan, because I need my best player to be able to step up in those kinds of moments when the defense is making it hard for everybody else to score. Yep. The best guy has to step up and say, all right, fellas, I got this, and either score the basket or
But he did step up, Mike. Kemba Walker, he said, I'm going to shoot the ball.
Well, that didn't work out too well. And yet, by the same breath, at the other end of the floor, Giannis had two or three blocks. He had two on LeBron, blocked his fadeaway, blocked the one layup. He had a block on, I forget who the other one was on. But, I mean, he was everywhere. I mean, he was everywhere on defense. And I just think it gave me pause when I watched that at the offensive end, thinking back to what happened in that Toronto series where they kept him from going all the way to the basket and the other Bucks weren't quite good enough to play off of him and knock down shots when they needed. And so if I'm Milwaukee, I'm looking at that going, whew, that could happen to us again. And that made me a little bit nervous watching that game.
Yeah, I agree. I took note of that too. I think it'll be interesting and see how, you know, he responds in the playoffs. Obviously, I'm not really concerned about them in the first round and probably not really concerned about them in the second round. It just depends on their matchups. I think that's really going to come down to it. And that's, you know, we can kind of transition into discussing some of the stuff of the second half here, at least for
one more thing.
Okay.
I can't let it pass without having a disparaging comment about James Harden.
Oh, we did. I did when he missed both those free throws. That was pretty good.
He missed the free throws that you sent me the text, big game James. But then on the last possession of the game where he caught the ball in the corner.
Oh, when he was going to lay on the lane, he should have just laid it up.
Yeah, and he had a layup. He basically had an uncontested layup, and he kicked it out and didn't shoot it. And then, I don't know, maybe this is just me reading into stuff, but it just felt like through the TV, like,
My favorite thing was when Reggie Miller goes, oh, he's used to kicking it out instead of taking a layup. I'm like, come on now, stop making excuses for him.
I don't know, it just didn't seem like guys were excited to be playing with him. So,
yep. All right.
Anyway,
so we'll briefly discuss a few things we're interested about the second half, but I think we have to start with John Beilein out as the Cavaliers head coach. The one thing that barely lasted longer than Chaka Khan's national anthem, John Beilein's coaching career in the NBA. When I got the text, I don't remember, was it yesterday, Mike, when I texted you? Or it was during the All-Star game, right? It was during the All-Star game that Woj reported it. And I'm like, well, this is convenient dropping time in the middle of the All-Star game. They're going to do this, and that he was thinking about not coming back. But as soon as I saw him saying he's weighing his options, I'm like, if he wants to have any kind of respect, there's zero chance that he's coming back now. This is being leaked out. This is out in the world. There's zero chance he's coming back. because what is he going to do? Come back and say, hey, guys, I decided that I'm going to stay and coach the rest of the season. I just felt like as soon as I saw that, he was out. Like, and, you know, obviously, I think that there's probably going to be some stories starting to come out about how rough it what really was, because obviously, you know, there was reports throughout the year that the players weren't really liking what he was doing. He's sitting there teaching fundamentals when they're professional players, and I can't imagine that Kevin Love was taking too kindly to, hey, guys, let's work on a bounce pass and chest passes. While they are essential skills, I mean, and like I said, I don't know all the nuts and bolts of it, but I'm sure stuff is going to start to trickle out now. And, you know, I kind of feel bad because I think Beilein was a great coach, and I thought, in theory, I thought that he was going to be good for the Cavs, but I think that at the same time, like, we didn't really know all the ramifications, and the fact that he's 67 years old, I can't imagine that the work that was going in. You know, I saw a tweet today before it was official, like, he still has 30, you know, some games left. That's longer than his normal college season was, and just kind of putting that into perspective, that this is far longer than the college season. The players are better, and he doesn't necessarily have as much control over them as he did. So I think there's lots of factors that came into this, and who knows? I just feel bad. I feel bad for Colin Sexton. This is his fourth coach in a year and a half, which is ridiculous. since LeBron returned, I think this is our seventh coach, right? Or the year before LeBron returned, this is going to be our
sounds about right. I don't know. Seventh coach. I'll defer to your expertise on that one.
What, Byron Scott and Mike Brown, and just over the last like 8 years, I feel like we've had, it's a competition between the Cavs and the Browns for coaching futility, quite frankly.
You're not a Ty Lue fan?
I mean, I guess Ty Lue was okay, but I mean, let's be honest, LeBron was really the coach when Ty Lue was the coach.
I would agree with that to a certain extent. All right, here's my take on the Beilein situation. So I really have three thoughts on this. Number one is that I think it's just very, very difficult for a guy who is 66 or 67 years old, whatever he is now, to go into something completely new, completely different, and be able to figure it out on the fly at that age. I just think it's difficult. I just think the amount of energy, the amount of effort that it's going to take, the learning curve, I just think is really steep. And so retroactively looking back at it, hiring someone at that age, not sure about. Number two, I still look at this as a hire by the Cavs that if I had to do it over again, I probably, despite what I just said about the age, I probably would do it again, because I'm always a favorite. I'm always a fan of, let's do something that is a little bit outside the box as opposed to hiring an average retread coach who's had two or three jobs that clearly is just mediocre. Let's take a chance that maybe Beilein turns out to be outstanding. Now, did it work out? No, but I don't think you can judge the decision at that moment with the result, at least not from the outside, without knowing what went on in the interview process and what's going on in practice every day and what it looked like before. So there's that. And then I think the last thing is like a greater trend or a greater big picture item, which is, what if you're an NBA general manager, NBA owner, should you hire a college coach? It's almost like drafting. I feel like it's almost like drafting an NFL quarterback, in that 50% of these college guys are going to end up being okay and doing well, and then the other 50% are just going to bomb out and be horrendous. And I don't know that you can predict which one you're getting in any given situation. It certainly doesn't seem that way. It doesn't seem like there's any scientific method that anybody's figured out of, okay, this is what you need in a college coach in order for the guy to be successful, because there's such a mixed track record of guys going from college basketball to the NBA. So I don't know what it means going forward for the Cavs. J.B. Bickerstaff's obviously an experienced NBA guy whose dad, Bernie, was a longtime coach in the league. So He's got experience.
He's done this multiple times before.
He has. So does it matter materially in terms of what happens? Does he have a chance to keep the job full time?
Well, supposedly they elevated him to full-time head coach. So I'm assuming they gave him some kind of deal here. I would assume that he's not. They didn't label him as interim head coach, Mike. They labeled him as head coach.
All right. So there's your answer. So
ESPN Stats and Info just put out an interesting tweet 3 minutes ago. So I'm going to read it to you. After agreeing to a 5-year deal last summer, John Beilein has coached his final game with the Cavaliers. Cleveland is the first team to have multiple head coaches in consecutive seasons since 2003, 2004, and 2004-2005. Two different teams had that happen in those seasons. Can you name them?
No.
The Knicks and the Magic.
Okay.
So that just shows you how bad the Knicks' futility has gone. Do you think about
it? The only thing that probably interrupted the Cavs' futility was LeBron being born in Akron. So
yeah, that's
true. I'm not sure we can laugh at anybody.
Yep.
So I don't know what's going to happen with the Cavs moving forward. Bickerstaff, whatever, it's fine. You still have to have players in order to be able to win, and the Cavs at this point don't have the talent that's necessary. Maybe these guys who weren't buying into Beilein will buy into Bickerstaff, and that'll maybe have the talent coalesce a little bit better, and maybe you win some more games, which, again, if you're the Cavs, I'm not sure that's what you want to be doing anyway. So I don't know. I still think that, at least based on how they were playing before the All-Star break, that they're the worst team in the league, and I would anticipate that that's gonna continue, especially if Steph ends up coming back from the Warriors. I think that the Cavs are going to be hard-pressed to not finish in the basement of the NBA, which, again, would be good for what we want to accomplish here.
Yep, I agree.
All right, next.
All right, so next on our agenda, we have to prioritize here. I think, what do you want to talk about? You can pick something,
Mike. All right, okay, let's just go. We have a couple questions that we talked about before the show that we wrote down. And let's just answer them without really going into much detail, because a couple of them we've already kind of talked about. So let's start out. Are the Bucks going to win 70 games?
I'm going to say yes, Mike. I'm ready to say it. I think they're going to win 70. I think they're going to win 70 on the nose.
So that means at this point they're 46-8, so they have to go 24-4 the rest of the way.
Yep.
All right, I'm going to say no.
Okay.
I'm going to say no. I'll give you – I'm going to say – I'll go 69 wins. 69 wins. I don't think they're going to go 70. I don't think they're going to go 70. All right, next question.
Number two seeds in each conference. Who do you think are going to be the number two seeds in each conference? I'll let you answer that one first, Mike.
All right, so if I was a betting man here, which I'm not, but I think that the number two seed in the East is going to end up being the Boston Celtics.
Okay.
Just because I'm still dubious of the Raptors, and I think Boston.
This goes back to last season. We were just dubious all year.
I'm dubious of the Raptors still. I was dubious of them last year, even when they won the title. I'm still dubious of them. So I don't know. I just can't buy the Raptors. So I'm going to say Boston is going to end up being the number two seed in the West. In the East.
Yep.
And then in the Western Conference, man, I right now Denver's sitting at number two. Clippers are a game behind. I still think the Clippers are going to get up there to the third seed, because I think that they have another gear still to get to. And
you mean they're going to get to the second seed?
I think they're going to get to the second seed. Okay. Yeah, I think they're going to get to the second seed. So I'm going to say the Clippers for the two seed in the West.
All right. So for mine, I'm going to stick with Toronto is going to stay in the two seed, Mike. And I was listening to something, and they were talking about how Toronto and Boston basically have the same strength of schedule the rest of the way, and how they don't feel that there's enough volatility. There's not going to be enough volatility to shake it up, and that they at this point. Toronto's going to stay there. And when I heard, you know, I thought Miami was going to kind of stick it to them, but kind of Miami's kind of fallen off. They're 4-6 in their last 10. So I'm going to go Toronto. And then for the West, it's so hard for the West because
like, I don't really, I can't say that I've sat and watched a full Denver Nugget game and been impressed with them. Like they lost to the Cavs in Denver. That should never have happened. Although me saying I haven't watched much Denver, I've probably watched more Denver Nuggets than Bew has because he can't watch it on his local television network.
Right.
Sorry, exactly. Bew. I'm going to go with something that you really liked last year, Mike. I think Utah is going to end up in the two seed. I think Utah
is. That's fair.
Because here's the thing. I don't think that Clippers, and I'm going to be brief. I don't think that the Clippers, we don't have enough. I don't have enough faith in them that they're going to be healthy enough to keep playing games, and people are going to, like, Kawhi's going to rest in games, and Paul George, he's been injured three times this year already. Who knows? He might have a hip flexor soon or something. I don't know. I don't have enough faith in the Clippers. That's why I'm going there.
Well, let's put it this way. It's clear that the Clippers don't care that much about it. I don't think they really care. I don't think that
I think that they're going to care. I think they're going to care, though, when they get, you know, if they get to the second round and they have to play Denver in Denver game seven, because, or whoever they're going to play in game seven and they're not at home, I think that matters.
I think it matters, but I don't think they care. I don't think they think that they can't win in one of those places. Now, conversely, I think Denver and Utah have got to be looking at it and going, man, if we can get to the two seed and we can get home court advantage in the second round of the playoffs, Denver's 21-7 at home. Utah's 20-5 at home. So both very good home teams with good home court advantages. And I think for both of those teams, if they could get to that two seed and have the first round be at home and the second round also be at home, I think that both of those teams, that's going to be important to them. So I can see that. I just think the Clippers ultimately are going to be good enough that they're going to creep up there despite the fact that they don't necessarily care all that much.
Okay.
So,
Rockets.
All right, let's go number 8 seed in the West. Who gets the number 8 seed in the West? We've talked about this a lot, so just give a team and we don't even have to go into reasons.
I'm going to say I'm going to say Memphis is going to stay there at this point. I think Memphis.
Yeah, I think Memphis too. I think Memphis has proven that they're not a fluke. I think they have, with the 4-game lead, and I'm sure with the amount of times that these teams all kind of in that Trailblazers, Spurs, Pelicans, Grizzlies, the times that they play each other and are going to kind of beat each other up, and I think it's going to be tough for any of those teams to go on what would have to be like a 8-2 run or a 9-1 run. I don't think any of those teams has that in them necessarily.
And I don't think Memphis is going to go 2-8 at any point. So
no, I agree. So I think Memphis is going to stay there unless, barring some kind of injury, I think Memphis holds on to that number 8 seed.
All right, most intriguing potential playoff matchups, and here's my answer to that, Mike. I think the 3-6 seeded teams in both conferences, I think those are the intriguing playoff matchups. Who knows what they're going to be because they're all bunched together right now. So, you know, we could hypothesize what they're going to be. But I think whoever the 3-6, the first...
What would be your favorite first round series in the East?
My favorite...
If you could just match them up based on what's possible.
Miami-Philadelphia.
Okay.
Because you have the whole Butler, Joel Embiid, drama, you know, all that stuff. I think that would be interesting.
I'm going old school. Sixers-Celtics is what I'd like to see in the first round.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I can understand that. So
just from an old school standpoint, seeing those two teams go at each other. And then in the West, I think,
I think Dallas Clippers would be fun in the first round. Although I don't want Luka to be out in the first round, so I think that would be fun. I think
Thunder Rockets would be a lot of fun.
Oh, that would be fun. That would for sure be fun.
That I think would be the best first round matchup. Unless we could somehow get, and I think the Lakers with either Memphis or if somehow the Pelicans, which I don't think is going to happen, but if somehow you could get the Lakers playing against Memphis or playing against the Pelicans and Zion, I think both of those, not that they would necessarily be super competitive, but I think those would be fun games. Whereas the Rockets and Thunder just has so many interesting subplots and little things that would go on amongst personalities with Westbrook and Paul and Harden and all that. I think that might actually make me tune in to watch
Rockets
basketball.
Man, I have to say, Mike, I don't remember realizing it, but, man, Simmons and Russillo hate watching Rockets basketball too. And I don't know if I've just tuned it out whenever they talked about the Rockets, but I don't know if you listened to the podcast from...
I did.
Man, they were really bashing it, and that was good. I like it. So Houston has two things going for it right now, Mike. Rockets being terrible basketball and the Astros.
Yeah, some we good don't stuff. Even need to talk about the Astros. That whole thing is a disaster. I told you before the podcast they should just strip them of the title, be done with it, and we always know that they want it on the field, but at least mentally you strip that title from them, and I think that everybody in baseball feels better that at least somebody's...
Oh, sorry, I was just giving you a signal. Sorry, I apologize.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, I appreciate that. I was looking for that curveball question that's coming up next.
Yeah. Well, we can talk. Will the Rockets small ball work? I guess would be my question to you, Mike. Will the Rockets small ball work?
Define work.
Will they be successful in the playoffs?
No.
No, I agree. All right.
I think maybe they win, depending on the matchup, they maybe win a round. There's no way they're winning a second round series.
I agree.
There's no way.
Okay, and then the last thing, Wiggins and the Warriors and Russell and the Wolves. Which do you think is going to be a better fit in the long term? I know my answer. My answer is Andrew Wiggins. I think that he, alongside Steph and Clay, I think that team, and Draymond, I think that team could be really, really good. Just watching the two games that he's played or three games that he's played, and I've seen some stuff, you know, obviously everything that's going on is going to be different when Steph and Clay come back. But I think the potential, the ceiling for that team is much higher than the ceiling for the Wolves.
All right, so you have to take a look at this within the context of what each team is. And so you have the Timberwolves, who have been a paragon of dysfunction now for years. And then you have the Warriors, who have been a paragon of stability and good front office management over the last 6, 7, 8 years. And you're plunking down a player into two distinctly different environments, having them trade from one spot to the other. So I think you have to look at it within the context. And within the context, you would have to say that it seems more likely that Wiggins is going to work out and mesh together better with the Warriors once all the guys come back. And that even if D'Angelo Russell ends up being really good for Minnesota, it just seems like I don't know what that means. Because until you get Towns to play some defense, and if he's going to be the alpha dog of your team, he's got to be the alpha dog, and I'm not sure that he's demonstrated any capability of doing that other than with his offensive statistics. So long term, I don't know that there's a whole lot of difference between the two players other than they play different positions, but they're both kind of guys that I'm not sure that they're I'm not sure where they rank on a winning team, if they can be the second, third, fourth, fifth best player. I don't know where Wiggins is on a title team. I don't know where D'Angelo Russell is on a title team. Part of me wants to say that D'Angelo Russell maybe is capable of being the second or third guy on a great team, depending on who he's surrounded by. It feels like we have more evidence of what Wiggins is, and yet it feels like Wiggins is going to have more success in Golden State than D'Angelo Russell is going to have in Minnesota. Partly for me, that's because I don't have as much faith in Karl Anthony Towns and the infrastructure of the Timberwolves as I do around Clay, Steph, and Draymond and the infrastructure of the Warriors. So if I had to bet, I would bet that this trade is going to turn out better for Golden State, but I don't know that it's a slam dunk for either team.
Yep. I agree, but I just think the potential is much better for them, so that's why I'm saying.
Well, Wiggins is such a great athlete that even if they just tap into getting him to play better defense and he continues to be sort of the same offensive player that he's always been but just in a lesser role, then you've got something. Because let's face it, the Steph, Clay, Draymond trifecta was good enough to win 73 games when they had some other guys, you know, they had a little bit of depth. So it's not like that group can't come back and win a title. And if Wiggins is your fourth best player, I think you're sitting in a fairly good spot.
Well, and I go back to the same statement that I feel like Wiggins is better than Barnes. And I just think, you know, I'm not saying that their team's going to be winning 73 games, but I definitely think that the potential for them to succeed at a high level is there. Because I think that Wiggins is better than Barnes. I'm willing
at worst, at worst, they're comparable.
Yes, I mean, I agree.
Depending on which guy you like, I mean, you could make a case for one over the other, but they're certainly comparable. Whichever one you think is better is not markedly two or three or four times better than the other guy. Whichever guy you like, you're splitting hairs in terms of which guy you like better, because each one brings something a little different to the table. But it's not like one is a borderline all-star and the other guy is a 12th man. They're fairly similar in terms of what they bring to the table.
Yep, I agree.
Whew, anything else?
I think we covered it all, Mike. 1 hour and 15 minutes.
Well, there was a lot to digest there from All-Star Weekend. It was a fun weekend, and I think it turned out about as well as the NBA could have hoped with the new format, and the guys played hard. It was competitive. It was a fun All-Star Weekend. I definitely enjoyed that All-Star game more than I have any game in a long time on All-Star Weekend. The dunk contest, despite the goofy ending, produced some spectacular dunks. The three-point shootout, although, as you said, I don't think it had maybe as much drama as some in the past have had, there was still some incredible shooting. So overall, a great weekend for the NBA. I think we're both looking forward to the stretch run here to see what ends up happening, which of those playoff matchups that we're looking forward to seeing, which ones we actually get to see. And I think there's, at some point here, come playoff time, there's going to be a little referendum on where Giannis is and if he's ready to take over that mantle as the best player in the world. He's going to get a chance to do it. And the Bucks and their supporting cast, hopefully they'll put him in a position that they'll be able to take advantage and show that whatever they do in the regular season, whatever that regular season and record ends up being, that it's not a fluke and that he's really ready to take over and become the guy for the next 3, 4, 5 years.
We'll see. I'm excited to see, and I'm excited to just kind of be able to digest the whole playoffs again like last year without having to worry about the Cavs. And because we sure as heck know the Cavs aren't going to be there.
It's a long way off for the Cavs, baby. A long way off to see the Cavaliers back in the playoffs.
Yeah.
So to everyone out there, thanks for sticking with us tonight. We appreciate you listening. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Hey, Hoopheads Nation. Check out this new offering from Tyler Whitcomb Basketball Coaching Courses. The Eric Musselman Arkansas Playbook by Nate Hinkle is now available. Musselman is the head men's basketball coach at the University of Arkansas. He's also a former NBA head coach with the Sacramento Kings and Golden State Warriors. Visit coachtube.com/users/Tyler Whitcomb to check out this great resource.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.